Good morning, everyone. So nice to see you all back again. So now we can continue on the suttas from yesterday. And the next sutta I'm going to do is one of those I do on every retreat because I think it is a very useful sutta. And it is how to deal with ill will and anger and that sort of thing. And just to show you how this works on the Noble Eightfold Path, how it fits in with Satipatthana practice and all of this. Remember what I was saying before, that the cause or the support for Satipatthana practice, including the mindfulness of breathing and all of this, the thing that you have to have in place for that to work is sila. Sila is the foundation. It's the basis on which to do meditation practice. And without a good foundation in sila, meditation is not going to take you very far. But the more powerful your sila is, the longer you develop it, the more years you practice it, the more you purify it, the more power it is going to give to your meditation practice. And if you remember back to the very first sutta we did, the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha says in that sutta that the cause, the problems are come originally from the mind. When the mind is impure, then we do obviously bad things by body and by speech. Yes, but if the mind is pure, then that cuts away all the problems in body and speech. So we can restrain ourselves. We can kind of hold back and live a pure life by body and speech to a large extent. But really, ultimately, in the end, we have to go back to the mind. And when we purify the mind, we actually do away with all those problems of morality in one go. So this is kind of the most important aspect of sila is actually dealing with the mind directly. Yeah. So how do we do this? How can we deal with the mind directly? How can we purify our mind in such a way that it will be this powerful support for our meditation practice? And this is what this is about. If you remember the Noble Eightfold Path, it starts off with right view, right intention. Then you have all the moralities. Then you have right effort. Yeah, and right effort, that is where the purification of the mind comes in. And then you have the Samma Sati, the Satipatthanas, which is the meditation part, always comes after the right effort, after you purify the mind. Now, of these defilements that the Buddha is talking about, he talks about greed, hatred, and delusion. Lobha, dosa, moha in the Pali language. And of those, the most important one, the most the one which is easiest to deal with is the dosa part, the ill will, the anger. So that is the one I would recommend you to put the most emphasis on. It is something that everyone here is able to deal with. It's not that hard, actually. It's the only hard part is really to commit, yeah, and to persevere in the practice. That is the hard part. But actually doing it is not that difficult. The principles are fairly simple. Yeah, it's just a different way of thinking from how most people think in life. And because it's a different way of thinking, that is kind of, you have to retrain your mind, get out of your old habits, yeah, and gain some new, the habits of the Buddha instead of the habits of samsara. The samsaric habits are not going to be very useful. So this sutta is called, in the Pali language, called the Agata Pati Vinaya Sutta. It's found in the Anguttara Numerical Discourses of the Buddha. And this is spoken by Venerable Sariputta. Sariputta was the right-hand monk of the Buddha. Sometimes you have like little, you know, when you see the Buddha, you have like little statues of monks, one on the left-hand side, one on the right-hand side. The one on the right-hand side is always supposed to be Venerable Sariputta. The one on the left-hand side, Venerable Mahamoggallana. Yeah, so when you see them, and when you, do you know how to recognize them? The monks, I've said this before, yeah, I think, the way to recognize the monk is the posture. They have a different posture with their hands. So Venerable Sariputta, he sits, I think he sits something like this. He holds one hand over here. Okay. That's the usual posture, whereas Venerable Mahamoggallana normally has his hands in Anjali like this. Most of the disciples, you see, they have their hands in Anjali. Venerable Sariputta has a more kind of different kind of posture. Not sure why that is. I think it's just to be able to distinguish them. I think that's the reason. Yeah. Anyway, So this is spoken by him, but it was always highly praised by the Buddha. It was always said that if the Buddha was not going to carry on the teaching, then Sariputta should be the one who keeps on rolling the wheel of the Dhamma Chakra in the world, because his wisdom was only second to the Buddha himself. He was almost on the same level. So it's very, very impressive. So let us see what he has to say. So this is how we then deal with this defilement of ill will and anger here. Okay, there the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus, friends bhikkhus. Friend, those bhikkhus replied, and the Venerable Sariputta said this: friends, there are these five ways of removing resentment by which a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, a layman, a laywoman should entirely remove resentment. So resentment is just the word which means ill will, ill will, anger, all that kind of stuff. Remove resentment when it has arisen towards anyone. What are these five? Here, a person's bodily behavior is impure, but their verbal behavior is pure. One should remove resentment towards such a person. A person's verbal behavior is impure, but their bodily behavior is pure. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time they gain an opening of the mind, placidity of mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, and they do not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. A person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time, again, an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind. One should also remove resentment towards such a person. So that is the summary, five kinds of people, and I've got some bad news for you. The bad news is that this includes everyone. You cannot exclude anyone. You cannot say, this, I have loving kindness for everybody except for this one person, who I find it really difficult. Everyone is included in these five categories, so you can't exclude anyone. Is that good news or bad news? It's actually good news, It's actually really good news. And one of the things about the Buddhist path is that we cannot really afford to have enemies in our life. If you have enemies, it means that there's going to be some blockage inside of you, some blockage from having metta, a blockage for purifying yourself. It's also going to be something you regret when you pass away. I don't know if you remember last night, we tried to do the death contemplation. And the first thing I said was, just imagine yourself lying in this room. You know that you're going to die in a few hours' time. What does it feel like? Are you ready to die? You have said goodbye to everyone. You will not be speaking to anyone after this. Are you ready to die? And sometimes you feel in your heart you're not ready. It's as if there are things in this world that you haven't done yet. Maybe you feel a regret about something. So the idea with this is to kind of remind you, if there is a problem in your life, something you have to resolve. If you have an enemy, that is usually something that you have to resolve in your life. So we can't afford to have enemies, because you might die. If you die with an enemy, what a terrible burden that is. You can never really afford to have any enemies. You can never afford to say anything bad to anyone, to do any bad acts, because you could die. This idea of death, it brings into the present moment the importance of your conduct right here and right now, because the next moment you could be gone. You never know about these things. It is so uncertain. And this is one of the reasons why the contemplation of death is one of the profound and beautiful contemplation on any kind of spiritual path, including the Buddhist one, because it makes the present moment so important. It reminds you what is important now, right here, right now. And this is how it kind of works. So please, don't have any enemies in your life. And this is what this is saying. This helps you, this way of thinking helps you to resolve any kind of conflict you have, at least inside of you. Sometimes externally it is impossible to avoid conflict, because sometimes other people you know, think they're not like you. Yeah, even though you are a very pure and kind person, sometimes people may not like you for whatever reason. There's nothing you can do about that sometimes. But at least inside of you, you can still have compassion for them. You can still have metta, even if somebody, for some reason, doesn't appreciate your company. And that is the resolution that we can find in life. And this is what the sutta is about. Resolving all interpersonal conflicts. So we don't have any anger, any hatreds, any problems in the world with other people. That's what this is about. And everyone is included here. So let us now look at each one of these in detail. The first one, it goes as follows. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior is impure, but whose verbal behavior is pure? Suppose a ragged road bhikkhu sees a rag by the roadside. He would press it down with his left foot, spread it out with his right foot, tear off an intact section, and take it away with him. So too, when a person's bodily behavior is impure, but his verbal behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his verbal behavior. In this way, resentment should, towards that person should be removed. So this is all about how we focus on other people. Yeah, we learn to focus on other people in the right way. People are complex. People have many aspects to their personalities. They will have bad sides. They will have good sides. So we learn to focus on the positive sides in other people. And this is incredibly useful when you go on a retreat like this, because when you go on a retreat, you have people around you all the time. They're going to irritate you every now and again. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's almost impossible that when you live so close to so many people that it will not irritate you a little bit. It's just par for the course. It just has to happen. That's just life is like that, because we kind of rub up against each other, especially when you share a room and all of these kind of things. So, but then you remind yourself that actually, these things are just small little things. Here I am in the company of people who voluntarily come on a retreat, not eating in the afternoon, not having entertainments, just coming to sit meditation and listen to the suttas of the Buddha, just to learn how to be kind. What a wonderful thing it is to share time with people like this. Yeah, this is how you think. It actually is a great privilege to be able to share time with people who actually want to do something good in life and to improve their lives and do what is right for themselves and others. And then you remember the big picture. You remember the important parts of a person's life. And then you realize that those little niggly things that happen in daily life is kind of irrelevant. Who cares if they slam the door a little bit too hard? Who cares if they snore at night? Yeah, actually, snoring at night is a bit of a nuisance. Yeah, you can't sleep yourself. But still, you forgive them, right? Still you forgive, because you understand. They don't actually do that on purpose. It's just that that's their character. This is what happens. So you remember the big picture. You remember the good qualities in people. It is quite easy with a group like this, because everyone who comes here is going to be a good person. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here. What's the point of coming here unless you are a good person? We know that already. It's a bit more difficult with other people who don't have the same commitment to spiritual practice. But even then, you will often find that people are complex. They will have good qualities. They will have bad ones. So you learn to focus on the good qualities. Yeah, you learn to see that. You build that up in your mind. You think, wow, what a wonderful thing that they have these good qualities. It's not really to be expected. We can't expect other people to have good qualities. It's marvelous when they're there. What about the bad qualities? Well, of course, everybody has bad qualities. It's to be expected. They get conditioned in the world where there's a lot of difficult and bad things going on. Of course, people are going to have bad qualities. It's to be expected. What is a miracle is that they have good qualities. That's the real miracle. Wow, well done. You have good qualities, yeah? And when you think like that, it becomes much easier to appreciate other people around you. You forgive the bad things, but you actually look upon the good things with a sense of happiness and appreciation and joy. Then these things come right. So let's have a look at the simile. There's a beautiful little simile here of the rag-robed bhikkhu, or perhaps the rag-robed bhikkhuni. I'm not sure. Is there any examples of bhikkhunis who wear rag robes at the time of the Buddha? Can you remember that? I'm not sure, but there may very well have been. Yeah. This was especially at the time of the Buddha when the monastics wore rag robes. Pangsukula, Chivara, rag robes. So, if you are wearing a rag robe and you see a rag by the roadside, you get very happy because then you get another rag for your robe. So you see this rag by the roadside and then you press it down with your left foot and you spread it out with your right foot. So the point here is to be able, you want to see the whole rag, yeah? So you spread it out in all directions so you can see what the rag looks like. And in the same way, when you see another person, you kind of look at the whole person. You look at all the qualities in the person, yeah? So you kind of spread out all the qualities in your mind, the good ones, the bad ones. You see everything that is there. Sometimes you can even write it down. Some people say this is kind of used in psychology, where you write down the qualities of the person, you know, the good ones and the bad ones, on two sides of a sheet of paper or whatever. Yeah, and then once you have spread out the qualities like that, you have seen the whole of this rag, and you tear off the good part, and what do you do with the bad part? You throw it out. Yeah, it's rubbish. It can't be used. It can't even be used for a rag robe because it is just too rotten and too smelly or whatever. It can't be used. So you throw it out. And it's exactly the same thing with the qualities of a person. You spread it all out. You see all the qualities, the good ones and the bad ones. Then you take the bad qualities. They are rubbish. They're not useful for anything. You throw them out like you do with all rubbish. You discard them. And then you take the good qualities and you carry them with you. Just like you carry this intact section of robe with you, you carry those qualities in your heart. You carry them around. And whenever you need those good qualities to remind you that this person has good qualities, you bring them out and you look at them and you remind yourself. And in this way, you help yourself to cool down any anger, any negativity you may have against this person. But remember, you have to act quite fast, because the problem is that once anger gets established inside of you, it's very difficult to get rid of. So you have to kind of see that anger is about to arise. Now you're looking at the bad qualities. As soon as you look at bad qualities, it doesn't take long before a little bit of ill will comes behind it. Yeah? You can see the causes. That's what I was saying yesterday about understanding the causes of these things. You can see the cause coming, and then you act quickly. Take out those good qualities from your heart. Remind yourself of the good qualities, and you abolish any ill will straight on the spot. It's a very powerful technique. Very, very powerful. And one of the things that I often like to remind people about how to deal with defilements. Very often we talk about sense restraint in Buddhism. It's called Indriya Sangvara Sila in Pali. The virtue of restraint of the senses. The Indriyas are the senses. And very often people think that Indriya Sangvara Sila is about restraint. The English word restraint means using force. So people think it is about using force. Yeah, you hold back, you stop the anger, you press the anger down. Okay, Indriya Sangvara Sila. But actually, it is not a very good way of practicing restraint. Why is that? And the reason is because, first of all, it is quite painful and takes a lot of energy to hold back like that. You have to use force and willpower. And once your mind gets tired of that willpower and you let go, it comes straight back again because you're just kind of suppressing it a little bit. Sometimes it disappears, but sometimes it just comes straight back again afterwards. So instead of you doing the restraint in this way, it is far more powerful to do the restraint using wisdom. Yeah, using wisdom power. And this technique we're talking about here, this is the technique of using wisdom power. If you look at the way the Buddha teaches how to overcome bad thoughts, there's a sutta called the Dveda Vitaka Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya number 19. Dveda Vitaka means two kinds of thought. And in this sutta, he explains to you how to overcome the bad thoughts and how to develop the good thoughts. How do you do it? And the Buddha says you do it by reminding yourself that these thoughts lead to suffering. These other thoughts lead to happiness. These thoughts lead you away from the path, away from Nibbana. These other thoughts lead you on the right track. So what he's saying is not using restraint, he's saying using wisdom. Think about it in the right way. As soon as you think about it in the right way, those thoughts are abolished. So this is about wisdom. So the Buddha's way of using, of restraining, is using wisdom on the path to learn to think in the right way. And this is exactly what we're seeing here. Yeah, throw out the rubbish. It is nonsense. It is not useful. It's not going to get you anywhere. Yeah, it is bad. And carry those with you, just like the rag road bhikkhu carries the rag with him. Now, people sometimes say, and they say that, well, this is not being realistic. Yeah, what do you mean just throw out the bad qualities? We know that people have good and bad qualities. Isn't Buddhism about yatha buddha jnanadarsana? Yatha buddha jnanadarsana means seeing things according to reality. Isn't that what Buddhism is about? If we deny the negative qualities in people, how can we see things according to reality? Isn't this going against the Buddhist teachings? And the answer is that not really, because we don't know what other people are like. It is only our perception. Yeah, I see someone, I may like, you know, all of you a lot, but there may be some other person who doesn't like you. Yeah, or there's always kind of different perceptions of people. We always see people in different ways. One person loves someone, another hates exactly the same person. So who is right? They're probably both a little bit right. There isn't any true nature of the people around us. It is only our perception. So we can never find the truth in that area. We can never see another person as they actually are. Why? Well, first of all, because they are complex. We can only see part of them. Secondly, because people are always changing. People are not fixed entities. This is what non-self is all about. So because they're not fixed entities, there is nothing you can really grasp hold of. This is why you can't compare people. This is why you have the idea of the three conceits in Buddhism. Yeah, the superiority conceit, the equality conceit, and the inferiority conceit. Because you cannot really feel like that compared to someone else. Why? Because there's nothing to compare. We're always changing, always moving from one thing to another one. So because there is nothing to compare, the idea that we should see another person as they actually are is flawed. It is impossible to see someone as they actually are. So we have to ask another question. We have to ask how it is useful to see another person. What is the way of looking at someone that leads you forward on the path? That is the critical issue. Yeah. So what is helpful? And what is helpful is to see the good qualities in other people. That is helpful for your practice. But interesting, it is also helpful for the other person. Because if you look at the good qualities in someone else, usually you encourage those good qualities. If you look at the flaws in someone else and you criticize them, usually they feel put down and actually those bad qualities become stronger. But if you know what it's like, if someone sees the good qualities in you, you feel inspired by that. You want to live up to that. You want to kind of, you know, show that you're worthy of that esteem. And so you actually improve your life and improve your game when other people see you in a good way. So it has a double benefit, benefit for yourself, but also a benefit for the other person when you see them in a good way like that. So it is very useful. So remember that. It is not about seeing things according to reality. Seeing things according to reality has to do with insight into your mind and body, not to do with insight into personal characteristics. We have to ask ourselves, what is useful? That is the right way of thinking about this. This is how we do this and how you do that. And remember, the important point here is to keep on looking. So sometimes you may be certain people in your life that you find difficult, and those are the people that you should deal with the most. Yeah, people who are close to you because you interact with them all the time, or people you find difficult. That's where the kind of the work has to be done, where you learn to perceive and look at people in a new and a different way. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. And let us move on to the next one. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose verbal behavior is impure, but whose bodily behavior is pure? Suppose there is a pond covered with algae and water plants. A man might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would plunge into the pond, sweep away the algae and water plants with his hands, drink from his cupped hands, and then leave. So too, when a person's verbal behavior is impure, but his bodily behavior is pure, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the purity of his bodily behavior. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have a person who has a different sets of qualities. His good qualities or her good qualities are in a different area, so we have to focus in a different area. And sometimes it can refer to the same person. People change, so the good qualities can also change around. So we learn to focus differently. The Buddha talks here about verbal qualities and body, not the Buddha, but Venerable Sariputta, about verbal qualities and bodily qualities. But I think this is just a general idea to show that people have varied qualities. It doesn't mean we have to make a distinction in that particular area. It's just a kind of a general idea that qualities vary. So here we focus differently. And the only difference here really is the simile. The simile is what distinguishes this one from the previous one. So here you have this man or a woman, anyone really, might arrive. And arrive means that you come into contact with someone else, and you are afflicted and oppressed by the heat. That means you have anger. That's what being afflicted means in Buddhism. You are angry or upset about something. A heat, you feel hot. It is there is a sutta called the Aditta Pariyaya Sutta, the sutta on the fire sermon, the fire discourse that was given to the 1,000 fire ascetics at the time of the Buddha, soon after his awakening. And he says, everything is on fire. What is it on fire with? Fire on greed, hatred, and delusion. Greed, anger is like a fire inside of us that excites the mind, makes it restless, running all over the place. It's hot, yeah? So heat is a metaphor in the suttas for defilements of the mind. So you are afflicted and oppressed by this anger. You want to get rid of it. You want to get out of this anger. It is actually very unpleasant. You know it's bad. You are weary. Why are you weary? Because it tires you when you get angry. Have you noticed that? If you get angry, you often feel tired afterwards. While you're angry, you have this false kind of anger energy. But afterwards, often you feel tired. You lose all energy is gone. And then you just have to go to sleep or something. Certainly, it's very hard to meditate either while you're angry or after you're angry. Both times is very difficult. So you are weary as well. And you are thirsty. Thirsty here is a sign. You want to find a way out. Yes, you're thirsty for some Dhamma or something like that. And you are parched. It's a bit like being weary, I suppose. And then what do you do? Well, what you do is this. You plunge into the pond. The pond here is a simile for the other person. You plunge like into their qualities. Yeah, you see all their qualities again. You sweep away the algae and the water plants. These are the bad qualities in the other person that you see. You sweep that away. It is, again, it's rubbish. You can't drink algae and water plants, so you sweep it aside. Get rid of that. And then, because you sweep that away, then you drink with your cupped hands of the water that is underneath. Yeah, you drink it on board. The pure water underneath all the bad qualities, you take it on board, you drink it up. And when you drink it up, it soothes you down. The heat disappears, all the parchedness is gone, and it cools you down, and you feel good about yourself. You drink in the good qualities of the other person. It cools down your mind, and you get back into balance again as a consequence. It's a beautiful idea of drinking in the qualities of the good qualities of other people. Don't drink the bad qualities. It's poison. Yeah, don't drink poison. Drink clean, pure water. That is the way to go. This is what this simile means. And then, of course, once you have drunk it, then you carry it with you afterwards. So that is the second simile, very similar to the previous one. Just the simile is different, but the idea is almost exactly the same of how to do this. Then we have the third one, and this is a slightly different situation, so we'll have a look at this one. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind? Suppose there is a little water in a puddle, then a person might arrive afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. He would think, there is a little bit of water in the puddle. If I try to drink it with my cupped hands or a vessel, I will stir it up, disturb it, and make it undrinkable. Let me get down on all fours, suck it up like a cow, and then depart. And he gets down on all fours, sucks the water up like a cow, and departs. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are impure, but from time to time he gains an opening of the mind, placidity of mind, on that occasion one should not attend to the impurity of his bodily and verbal behavior, but should instead attend to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind he gains from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So here we have a person who has only a little bit of good qualities. Yeah, the speech is no good, the bodily action is no good. So quite sounds like a quite unpleasant person. And then, but what they have this opening of the mind, placidity of mind. And what this means, it means that placidity of mind means the mind is peaceful. Yeah, placid, like peaceful and calm, without waves. Opening of the mind is the opposite of nivarana. Nivarana is the hindrances in the Pali language, the five hindrances. This is called the vivarana. Vivarana is like the opening, the opposite of the nivarana. You don't have any hindrances. So this is like the person who occasionally gains a bit of samadhi, a bit of peace in the meditation practice. Yeah, so they may have bad speech, bad conduct, but still they get peaceful in the meditation sometimes. Do these people exist? Yes, they do. Yeah, and people say it's really unfair. I've been practicing so long, I've been being kind to everyone. I can't get any peace in my meditation. How come these scallywags get peace in their meditation? Sometimes people say that. And life is not fair, right? This is the first thing to remember. Life is not. Actually, it is fair. When you look at things in the long run, it is fair. But it seems unfair in the short run. The reason this happens sometimes, most people who have bad speech and bad conduct, they don't have any meditation at all. But sometimes you get people who get good meditation even then. And the reason, of course, is because our past is so imponderable, goes back such a long time. Our characters are so complicated. Yeah, so many interweaving things are happening. That this is why sometimes even bad people do this. It can happen. So it's not just a fantasy here. But of course, in the long run, if you keep on doing bad things by body and speech, eventually you will lose that peace that you have in your meditation practice. So the only way to get peace in meditation in the end is by living well. But if there is such a person, then we should focus on those good qualities. Yeah, we should rejoice in the fact that at the very least, they get some peace, they get some beautiful mind states. And sometimes you can tell that from people. You can tell that even if they externally don't behave very well, you can tell that there are some inner good qualities in people. Just by observing them carefully, you can see that. So you notice that, and you rejoice in that. You do like the cow, yeah? The cow has, the person has to act like the cow. This is a cow practice. You get down on all fours, yeah? You don't try to use your hands with this tiny amount of water, tiny amount of good qualities. You have to focus very narrowly, focus on that. If you look a little bit too much that way, you see the bad qualities. You focus very narrowly on those good qualities are there. And then you rejoice in that. You think how wonderful that is. You get down, you suck up the water like a cow, and then you are able to give rise to a wholesome mental state based on that. What is interesting about this is that it means that we should go to as far as possible to try to see the good qualities in other people. This is what this means. Yeah, we should really try our very utmost to see if there is any goodness there. This is what this is referring to. Why is that? And I think one of the reasons for that, when you know the Buddha talks about the four Brahma Viharas. Yeah, do you all, everyone know the Brahma Viharas? Where is the person who was new to Buddhism? The one who hasn't been around for so long. Do you know, have you heard about the Brahma Viharas? Okay, good. Now I can teach you something new, yeah? You knew about the middle way, but not the Brahma Viharas. So the Brahma Viharas, it means, it's often translated as the divine abiding, so the divine dwellings. So Brahma is like the gods in a very high realm, yeah, where it is very, very peaceful and very quiet. You get into very deep meditation. It's like you get access to the Brahma realms. It's like you get reborn in this very beautiful high realm. And Brahma and Vihara means to dwell or to live. So you live like those gods in the very high realm. That's what it means. And these gods in these very high realms, they are characterized by certain qualities. And the qualities they have are considered to be four in the suttas, or four prominent qualities anyway. And these four qualities are, in the Pali language, are called metta, karuna, mudita, and the last one is upeka. And in English, usually translated as loving kindness. Yeah, they are full of love. They have compassion, karuna. Mudita means like joy or sympathetic joy. And upeka means like an evenness of mind, often translated as equanimity. Mind is very even, yeah? You know, not ruffled by things. The mind is not like a zigzag, which it is for people a lot of the time. It's very even. So these are the qualities. Now, these qualities are always given in a certain sequence. It is always metta first, then karuna. Yeah, first loving kindness, then compassion, then the joy, sympathetic joy, and then the equanimity. And remember, when the Buddha gives his teachings, everything is in a certain sequence. Nothing is random. The sequence actually matters in all of these things. What it means is that the most basic of these four is metta. Loving kindness is the most basic one. That is the one we should focus on first. That is why the Buddha here gives a lot of emphasis on the metta. Yeah, all of this is really metta practice, because we're looking at the good qualities in other people. That's what metta is all about. Seeing the good qualities in others. Putting a lot of emphasis on metta. The next one, number four, which we'll come to very shortly, is about compassion. That is karuna. But before we come to compassion, we try our very best to see the good qualities in other people first of all. Then, if we are completely unable to see the good qualities, then we go to compassion and use compassion instead, because that is then the only way to do it in that situation. So the Buddha says, always try metta first. Then when you have tried your very best to practice metta, if that doesn't work, then you go to compassion. Why? Why is this so important? And one of the reasons why this is important is when we focus on compassion, we are also usually focusing on suffering. Yeah? Compassion is this idea that we want to help other people come out of their suffering. So we're focusing on suffering. And when we focus on suffering, it is easy, it can happen, that we then become a little bit sad because we start to see the suffering in the world. Yeah, so it is more tricky. Compassion is more tricky than metta. It is more difficult to get it right. If we get it wrong, sometimes I heard many people say this to me before. Oh, I feel so sad sometimes. I see all the suffering in the world. We're supposed to see all the suffering and take it on board and then have compassion for everyone. But actually, I just feel sad about it. Exactly, that's the whole point. It is difficult to get it right. Therefore, you start with metta instead, because metta is never wrong. It is never wrong to focus on the good qualities in others. It would never lead to any bad consequences. It will always have a positive outcome. This is why the Buddha focuses on this so much. So start with that, yeah, and put a lot of emphasis on that. And then, if that doesn't work out, then we go on to compassion afterwards. Yes? Okay, so that is what this is what the Buddha is trying to say here. So even when there is just a tiny bit of good qualities, we rejoice in that. And we think, what a wonderful thing it is that even this person who has so many bad qualities, there's a little bit there we can focus on and we can have metta as a consequence. So now let us take a short break and let's come back again in about 10 minutes and continue in 10 minutes time. Okay, I hear someone's got a bit of a cold. Everyone okay? Yeah? Everyone all right? Okay. There's always, the body always unreliable, always throws little wobblies, yeah? And you get like colds at the wrong time and all this kind of thing. So that's another teaching right there. But anyway, let us continue on this sutta about ill will. And now we have, as I just said, we have looked at the ways to use metta to overcome any ill will we may have. And now we're going to have a look at compassion, because now we come to the person where we cannot see any good qualities. Yeah, we see all we see is bad qualities. And then, of course, if you can't see any good qualities, there's nothing to focus on. We have to have a different strategy. And the strategy now is the compassion, the karuna strategy instead. This is how it goes. How, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are impure, and who does not gain an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, from time to time? Suppose a sick, afflicted, gravely ill person was traveling along a highway, and the last village behind them and the next village ahead of them were both far away. They would not obtain suitable food and medicine or a qualified attendant, and they would not get to meet the leader of the village district. Another person traveling along the highway might see them and arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for them, thinking, "Oh, may this person obtain suitable food, suitable medicine, and a qualified attendant. May they get to meet the leader of the village district. For what reason? So that this person does not encounter calamity and disaster right here." So too, when a person's bodily behavior are impure, and he does not gain from time to time an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should arouse sheer compassion, sympathy, and tender concern for them, thinking, "Oh, may this venerable one abandon bodily misbehavior and develop good bodily behavior. May they abandon verbal misbehavior and develop good verbal behavior. May they abandon mental misbehavior and develop good mental behavior. For what reason? So that with the breakup of the body after death, they will not be reborn in the plane of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed." So here we have the person who, where we cannot see any good qualities. Yeah, all we see is bad speech, bad bodily behavior, and bad mental behavior. There's nothing to focus on to make metta possible. And the first thing to remember about this is that when we cannot see any good qualities in the person, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person doesn't have any good qualities. What it means is only our personal perception. We can't see it. Other people might be able to see good qualities in that person. They may very well have some good qualities, but we can't see it. That is already an important point, because what it means is that we allow that we always have a little bit of doubt. We're not too sure of ourselves. We understand the limits of our own perceptions. Yeah, we know we can never see a person fully. Because we understand that, we allow the possibility that things may change in the future. Yeah, maybe in the future, maybe a few weeks' time or a few years or whatever, suddenly things change, and then we start to see the good qualities in that person instead. We don't lock them into this kind of box and say, "Bad person," with BAD written over the box, yeah? And now permanently, forever after, they are bad, consigned to being bad. No, we give them the opportunity. That is actually an act of compassion in its own right, an act of kindness, to give people the possibility to show other sides, not to classify them once and for all in a certain way. That is almost like an act of violence, to classify people once and for all, and never allowing them to change and to show their good qualities. This is the first thing. Remember, it is always your perception that we're dealing with, our own perception that we're dealing with here. We're not actually dealing with what the person is really like, because that is impossible to know. This is, even the person themselves don't really know that. So it cannot be the basis for any mental development. But anyway, so if we cannot see the good in that person, then of course what we do, we have compassion for them. And the way you do that is precisely the way that this simile works. Yeah, you see, if you see a person who is really sick, who's walking along a highway, and it's like a desert road, there's nobody around, nobody to look after them, doesn't get any medicine or anything like that. Well, you know, if you are sick, you're going to die if nobody looks after you. Yeah, eventually, you're just going to, that's it, you're finished, and then you die. And how do you feel about a person when they are sick? Do you get angry with them for being sick? Or do you feel compassion for them when they're sick? Usually you have compassion, yeah? And the reason you have compassion is because it is not usually a fault of their own. Being sick is just what the body does. Occasionally the body gets sick and there's nothing we can do about that. It's just the nature of having a body. It gets sick every now and again. You don't blame them. You don't go, hey, you got cancer. It's because of all the... Sometimes people do that. All the bad karma you made, yeah? That's why you have cancer. But then the good people get cancer as well. Everyone gets cancer. Everyone gets the flu every now and again. Everyone gets sicknesses. It's just the nature of this body. To blame people for getting sick is being very silly. Rather, we have compassion for them. And that is kind of the point. The point here is that if someone lives in a bad way, if they do bad acts by body, speech and mind, they are sick. Yeah, they are ill. They are deluded. They don't know what they're doing. Everyone in this world wants to be happy. And here is someone creating unhappiness for themselves by living in the wrong way. They are deluded. They have no idea what's going on. So when someone who wants happiness is actually creating unhappiness for themselves because they don't understand what's going on, how do you feel about them? You feel almost like a sense of compassion straight away. They think they are creating happiness for themselves when actually they're just creating suffering. So when you see someone doing something bad, remember that this is a person who is deluded. This is a person who is sick. This is a person who has no idea that they're creating suffering for themselves in the future by acting in a silly way, by being stupid. So you look at them, you think, I have compassion for you. You don't know what you're doing. You are actually creating suffering even though you want to be happy. And in this way, you can have compassion for almost anyone in the world because you know that they are acting against their own best interest. And anyone who acts against their own best interest, they are worthy of compassion because they are blind, they're in the darkness, they are fumbling around, having no idea what they're doing. That is always very painful to see. And this is particularly powerful if someone does something bad against you. Yeah, if someone is kind of using bad languages towards you, telling you off, saying bad things to you. Maybe you know your boss is in a bad mood one day and kind of you know says nasty things. I don't know what things are like in Hong Kong if this happens, but probably does. Yeah, it happens everywhere. So when it is you, it is particularly hard because it feels so personal. Yeah, they are doing it against me. It's personal. It is not personal. This is what you have to understand. These things are never personal. The reason why this other person is saying bad things to you is not because of you. It's because of them. Yeah, it's because of their delusion, because of their conditioning, because of their things coming together for them in a certain way. They, and you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah, and then bang, it hits you like that. It's got nothing to do with you. You don't have to feel bad because this is happening. It's their problem. And once you understand that it is their problem, and once you understand that they are deluded, that they are creating suffering for themselves, they're making bad karma for themselves, what you do, instead of focusing on yourself, that is when you get angry. You focus on the other person. You see their suffering, their problem. Then you can have compassion instead. It's like you're turning the table. And thinking about ourselves is actually so painful. It is so limiting. It is so self-centered. Yeah, not having to think about ourselves frees you up. You get this expansive mind, and you get this beautiful mind, which kind of brings in the whole world. You have compassion and kindness for everyone. Being selfish is actually a painful state of mind, because it's very limited, it's very small. You're kind of locked into your own little world. Me, my world, don't touch my things, yeah, stay away. Help, I'm scared of the whole world. It's very small and very narrow. The mind kind of contracts into yourself. But when you don't have that selfish attitude, your mind expands out. It's a beautiful mind. greed is good. It's madness. Greed is bad. It creates a very small and negative mind state inside of you. Instead of having this broad, beautiful mind of kindness and compassion for the whole world. I'm sure you know what you're talking about. If you just think about when you feel greedy and self-centered, what does that feel like? It feels small. It feels narrow. What does it feel like when your mind expands out and takes in many more people? It feels actually very beautiful. Yeah, it feels, it's fearless, it is expansive, it is a mind which is light and buoyant and beautiful. There's a big difference there between selfishness and not being selfish. And focus on those things and then you will start to understand how this works. So when the other person is saying something bad to you, it's nothing to do with you. You don't have to take it personally. It's never personal. It's about the other person. So you look at them and you think, I have compassion for you. I know right now you're probably hurting. Don't say this, right? It makes the thing much worse sometimes. But you don't have to say anything. You just know that this is the truth at the time. And then when you have compassion like that, you can let it go so much more easily. And then you're not affected by anger. You don't let their bad mood affect you. Instead, you just flow through the world evenly. And you take all the good and all the bad things that come your way in life. Evenly, smoothly like that. It's a very nice way of living. You flow through the world, yeah? Through the difficult times, through the good times. And it doesn't affect you so much anymore. So this person is sick. Remember that, the bad person. And then you can have compassion for them as a consequence. And of course the medicine here, the medicine that we gain especially is of course things like the teaching of the Buddha. That is the real medicine. Yeah, so this person doesn't get any medicine. So if you want to really turn someone around and make them see the world in a different way, you need something profound like the Buddha's teachings to be able to do that. And then their behavior will often change as a consequence. Anyway, there you are. That is this beautiful simile of the sick person. Now, let us come down to the last one. And how, friends, should resentment be removed towards the person whose bodily and verbal behavior are pure, and who from time to time gains an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind? So this is like the really saintly person, yeah, whose bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure and who also has good mental behavior at the same time. This is like the saint. This is like the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha has an opening of the mind probably all the time, but it is kind of people of that kind, yeah, the noble ones, that sort of people. Suppose there were a pond with clear, sweet, cool water, clean with smooth banks, a delightful place shaded by various trees. Then a man might arrive, or a person might arrive, afflicted and oppressed by the heat, weary, thirsty, and parched. Having plunged into the pond, they would bathe and drink, and then, after coming out, they would sit or lie down in the shade of a tree right there. So too, when a person's bodily behavior and verbal behavior are pure, and from time to time again an opening of the mind, placidity of the mind, on that occasion one should attend to his pure bodily behavior, to his pure verbal behavior, and to the opening of the mind, the placidity of the mind that you gain from time to time. In this way, resentment towards that person should be removed. So this is the easy person to remove resentment from, because this is like the saintly person, someone who has lots of good qualities, and it's quite easy to find those good qualities. It's not that hard. But the point, of course, here is that even if someone is really saintly, still people get angry with them. People got angry with the Buddha. There's many examples of that in the suttas, of people coming to the Buddha and shouting at him and telling him off. One example is Akosaka Bharadvaja in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Akosaka means abusive. Yeah, so Akosaka means the abusive Bharadvaja. Bharadvaja was a typical Brahmanical name at that time in India. So Bharadvaja, the abusive, and he abuses the Buddha. And because the Buddha had, I think, ordained one of his brothers or something like that, he wasn't happy with that. So he went to the Buddha and abused him. And the Buddha just looked at him and I think I told this here last year. It's a nice little simile that the Buddha uses, the simile of the meal. It's like if you, the Buddha said, well, you know, he said to, after he's finished abusing him, he says to this Bharadvaja, he says, well, if you are at home and you invite lots of guests to a meal, yeah, and the guests have their meal, and then when they finish, there is leftover food. Who does that leftover food belong to? Well, it belongs to me, says Bharadvaja, because I am the one who gives the meal. And then the Buddha said, well, exactly in the same way, you spewing out all this abuse towards me, but who does that abuse belong to? It belongs to you. Yeah, it goes back to you. I don't accept it. I don't take it on board. You are the one who gets the result of all this abuse. It's a nice little simile. You have to own that abuse. If you abuse someone, you are the one who own it at the end of the day. And it comes back to you in a bad way. So we have to be careful when it comes to people who are very spiritually attained. We have to be careful. And it's an interesting question. How do we deal with people who are spiritually attained? Should we just always be kind? Should we never be critical? Should we never abuse? Should we never say any bad? How should we deal with these kind of things? An important point here is that you never actually know who is spiritually attained. Yeah, very often it is our own projections. We think that someone is spiritually attained, and it turns out they're not. And this leads to a lot of problems in the world, because people get very disappointed when someone they thought was very saintly actually turns out to be very ordinary. And they disrobe and they do all kind of bad things. So it's very disappointing when that happens. So that's why I said at the beginning, when we have faith in the Triple Gem, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, we have faith in the Sangha as a whole, and there will be certain individuals who represent that, but we don't place too much confidence in faith in individuals, because if you do that, you end up being very disillusioned and disappointed sometimes. So what is the right attitude? And the right attitude is that we have to be critical. We have to use our critical faculties. We cannot just say, oh, it's bad to kind of think bad things about certain people, so I'd better just shut my eyes and pretend that nothing is happening. That is just being stupid. Yeah, that is just being silly, because we have to use our critical faculties to decide where faith should be placed, who is worthy of confidence. This is just so important. So please don't throw out your critical faculties. I've seen that too many times. People say, oh no, this person is an arahant. Don't think a bad thought. Don't say anything bad thing about this person, because it's bad karma. But it's not an arahant. Everybody knows it's not an arahant. It's just that everybody says so, and everybody's afraid of criticizing it. So it becomes this collective delusion when somebody's called an arahant, even though they are absolutely not worthy of that qualification. So please don't be scared of using your critical faculties. In fact, one of the things that the Buddha says, this is in the Anguttara Nikaya, he says that speaking dispraise of someone worthy of dispraise is good karma. It is a good thing to do. Speaking praise of somebody worthy of praise is good karma. But you do so after reflection, after carefully evaluating. Yeah, you evaluate very carefully what is going on. If someone is abusive, we have to bring it out into the open. Otherwise, other people are going to suffer from the same abuse. We can't just shut it down. Yeah, we had this kind of the Me Too campaign happening around the world. And it's good that these things sometimes get out, so we can purify our society a little bit from some of these bad things that are going on. So we need to deal with these issues. And it's important that we talk about things that are, but we do so in a reasonable way. Yeah, we do it in after investigating. We don't gossip, and we don't do it in a kind of haphazard way and just kind of, you know, spew out our defilements into the world. But we do so carefully in the right way, then we are doing it in the appropriate manner. So this is the right way of being critical. You observe carefully. And what you say it with care. You say it with balance. You don't get angry. You just state what is fact, so that you can help other people to find the right way and avoid being abused and all of these other kind of things. That is the right way of doing these things. Don't be afraid of being critical if criticism is valid. It's important to be able to be critical when criticism is necessary. Otherwise, we're just blindfolding ourselves. We're becoming stupid otherwise. There's no point in being stupid. That actually just goes against the whole path. So you might become angry sometimes, even with people who are really saintly. Yeah, and this is how it goes. But then afterwards you realize that actually it is your problem, because you realize that this person actually has lots of good qualities, and then you focus on those good qualities. Yeah, so you come to this pond and the water is so beautiful. Yeah, it is sweet, it is clear, it is cool, it is clean. Yeah, so you plunge into that pond with this beautiful water and you drink up all those qualities. And as you do that, of course, you are soothed, because the qualities actually are so nice. It's very easy to see what is going on. And then the interesting twist here is that afterwards, after coming out of the pond, you actually, it says here that you plunge into it, and afterwards you come out and you lie down right there in the shade of that tree, which is like a bit like you become a disciple of that person. Yeah, they have so many good qualities, you might as well become a disciple of them. So after you let go of your anger, then you hang out with that person. Yeah, it's like me. I hang out with Ajahn Brahm for a long time. Sometimes I get a bit upset, but I realize it's my own stupidity when I get upset. I still hang out with Ajahn Brahm afterwards. Yeah, so it's very nice. So then you kind of hang out with somebody, because when you live with somebody all the time, it's very difficult never to be a little bit irritated by things. That's just the way things are. So you let go of that, and then afterwards you become a disciple, and you hang out with that person because you see all the good qualities in that person. And people like that are like the shining example in the world. The people that we take for our teachers, ideally, they are people who have all the right qualities, like the Buddha, like all the arahants, both Teris and Teras after the Buddha's time, that you can read about in the Teri and Theragata, and also some modern examples as well. When you look around the world, there are still some very good monks and nuns around in the present day. Also some very good lay people, actually. Sometimes I'm impressed by how some lay people practice. We should never focus simply on the monastic sangha. Wherever goodness is to be found, it is to be looked upon with sense of gratitude and a sense of inspiration to be followed by others. So that is what you do, and this is something I said that on the very first day, I think, that when there are arahants in the world, it doesn't necessarily have to be arahants, it can be Aryas, anyone who has noble qualities. It is such a wonderful thing in life, in the world, that these people exist. And even seeing a person like that is very powerful. Because when you see a person who is consistently kind, consistently peaceful, consistently reasonable, consistently wise, never really getting angry, after a while it kind of opens your eyes. You realize that there is another possibility in this world. Yeah, you're used to seeing ordinary people, and it's not all that inspiring. Okay, even if they are very wealthy and powerful, so what? They're still kind of ordinary in many ways. You know, who cares about wealth and power? It's just not going to make that much difference in your life. But then you see someone who is perhaps living in the forest, far away from other people, not talking to anyone, never dealing with other people, staying by themselves. And still, they are far more happy than anyone you have seen anywhere else. How is it possible? How can you just live in solitude for 6 months at a time, not seeing anyone, and still be more happy than anyone else? This is what you see here. And when you see that, when you see this arahant, you feel so inspired, because you realize that there is another possibility in this life. There is another way of living. There is a way of developing your mind that leads to something very powerful and very beautiful. And you realize, you too, actually, I too could do with some of those qualities. Yeah, that's what you realize. It inspires you, it lifts you up, it shows you that there's something more in this world than just ordinary life and ordinary things. And this is why this is the example of the arahants. Just seeing somebody like that lifts you up, and it drives you forward, and it makes life so much worthwhile as a consequence. You're starting to understand that life does have a profound meaning, a profound purpose, somewhere that we can go, somewhere that is really has a point to it. And that's why the very last line, which I left out, says, "Friends, by means of a person who inspires confidence in every way, the mind gains confidence." Yeah, this is what happens. The person who, the Buddha or the noble ones or someone who is practicing really well, this is what happens. So that is the person who has all good qualities, and this is how you become, how you have metta towards them. It's obviously very easy, and they become a very inspiring example. These friends are the five ways of removing resentment, by means of which a bhikkhu can entirely remove resentment towards whoever it has arisen. So that is the sutta, the Agata Pativinaya Sutta, and how to remove resentment. So again, just to remind you that the main thing here is about metta practice. Metta is actually really about seeing the good qualities in others, rejoicing in those good qualities, and then developing the mind on that basis. And tonight I thought we can try to do a metta meditation together. Somebody asked about that. I think that's a good idea, and see if we can make it work. And it is based on similar kind of principles. But one of the first things that you have to do if you're going to develop metta is that you have, first of all, to let go of the anger, let go of the resentment. Yeah. So first of all, we let go of the resentment. This is what you do by these methods. And then once that is gone, then you move on to the metta practice. There is a sutta which is not included here. It's called the Kakachupama Sutta, the simile of the saw, famous sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya number 21. And it shows you that the way to develop metta is that if there is a person you have problems with, you actually start the metta practice with that person. This is very different from the way we are normally taught, because normally the way we are taught is the method taught in the Visuddhimagga. According to Visuddhimagga, the way to start is you start with a friendly person, then the neutral, then the kind of the less friendly person. Yeah, there's a sequence. But according to the suttas, especially once you have developed your mind to a certain stage, you actually start with a person who is difficult. Why is that? And the reason for that is because it is assumed that already you don't have any enemies already. You already have developed yourself a fairly long way on the path. You don't have any enemies. So if someone comes who might become a potential disturbance, a potential enemy, you start with that person to ensure that you don't actually make any enemies in this life. So you start off with that. You neutralize any possibility of negativity in your mind straight away. Yeah, so you start with that person, and then when that person kind of has been neutralized, you have kindness towards them, then you have metta towards all the four directions. It is interesting when you look at the suttas and you compare it to later Buddhism. Visuddhimagga is, for those of you who don't know, is a meditation manual almost, written by a very famous monk called Venerable Buddhaghosa. He was a monk who lived in Sri Lanka in about the 5th century AD, and he wrote this Visuddhimagga, and there's a lot of interesting things in there. I've only read little bits, to be honest. I never read the whole thing. I was never really interested, because my focus was always on the suttas. But it's interesting, when you compare the Visuddhimagga to the suttas, you see that there is slight differences, yeah? And this is one of those differences, how you practice metta meditation. So which one is right? Well, the first thing to know is that often different methods can work, yeah? There is no such thing as one thing being right and one thing being wrong. So the method taught in the Visuddhimagga may be right for some people. If it works for you, please use it. But I must admit, I tend to lean towards the way the Buddha teaches things. So if the Buddha says that this is the way to do things, then I try to follow that. But sometimes I also realize that the way the Buddha teaches, particularly the Brahmaviharas, is a very high standard of Brahmaviharas. So sometimes you have to be humble and realize, okay, I will start on a little bit lower level, yeah, because my mind isn't so developed yet. So you start with something else. Sometimes you just try different things and see how it works. And then you can choose the Visuddhimagga method or the Sutta method. But I think it's always useful to choose how the Buddha taught, because he is the supreme master. Buddhaghosa is, after all, only a disciple of the Buddha, just like all the rest of us. And there was another example of that just previous today. One of the participants here, she asked me, "Yeah, what you're saying 31 parts of the body? How can we say 31? I always taught 32 parts of the body." The reason for that is exactly the same. The reason for that is that in the Visuddhimagga, it teaches the 32 parts of the body. In the suttas, it is 31 parts of the body. And it's very interesting because people always think it is 32 parts of the body. And it shows you how influential the later Buddhism has become. Often we use the later Buddhism more than we use the earlier Buddhism. That's why everybody knows about the 32 parts, but not the 31 parts. That's why they know about how to practice metta according to the Visuddhimagga, not according to the suttas. Because we focus more on the commentaries and later tradition rather than the earlier tradition. It is given away when we hear how people talk about this things. Of course, whether you think 31 parts or 32 parts, it doesn't make any difference. Yeah, it's completely irrelevant, really. I'm just making the point that this shows you how we focus on these things. So what is that 32nd part? You know what that is? 32nd part that is found in the Visuddhimagga? You know that? You know which one it is? 32nd part is the brain. Yeah. So the Visuddhimagga adds the brain. If you look at that list we were looking at the other day, there's no brain in there. But in the Visuddhimagga, they add the brain. So does it matter if we add the brain or not? If you want to contemplate the brain, please contemplate the brain, yeah? So it's just whatever. It doesn't really matter. I'm just making the point just to show you that there tends to be a difference between the earlier tradition and the later one. And sometimes, in some context, it may actually make a difference. So, based on these things, then this evening we will try to do the metta meditation. And I will show you how to take this through step by step. And if you don't feel anything during the metta meditation, don't worry too much about that. Many people find it quite hard to feel anything because we're not used to thinking in this particular way. But by developing these ideas again and again and again, by looking at people in this way, by developing the positive perceptions, eventually you will start feeling things in the metta meditation. And that is when metta becomes very enjoyable and very powerful and a very important part, I would say, of the Buddhist path. It is on the day of kindfulness later on, I probably will read out a short sutta which shows the benefits of metta practice, the Metta-Nisangsa Sutta, which then shows you the benefits. And one of the benefits of metta is very easy to meditate afterwards. Okay, instead of just continuing talking, I will stop there because now it is almost 11 o'clock. So please continue enjoying your day, have a nice lunch, and we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon. So